Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Mac and the Movies. I'm your host, Mackenzie Lambert. We are now at part three of our journey through volume one of the Grindhouse Experience from Fortune 5 DVD. For this episode, we have a double bill of crime films, The Violent Professionals and Mean Frank and Crazy Tony, paired with a double bill of Chop Saki Hong Kong Kung Fu films, Kung Fu Punch of Death and Return of the Tiger. Plus, I have a rant on the importance of physical media over streaming services and digital. Without further ado, let's get started. The Violent Professionals begins with a prison transport via train. Two of the prisoners get loose and escape, but not before killing the guards on board. They stop a passing car driven by a father with his young daughter in the passenger seat. One of the prisoners violently kills the father before taking the car along with the daughter inside. In tears over the death of her father, the little girl loudly whimpers, which only irritates the prisoner driving the car. He demands the other prisoner kill the little girl. The other prisoner takes aim at the girl, and the film cuts away just before the shot is fired, as if they have the good taste not to show a little girl getting machine gunned. A squad of officers under the supervision of Giorgio track the prisoners to a nearby quarry. Gunfire exchanges lead to the prisoners telling they'll surrender. Giorgio snuck up to them during the gunfire. The prisoners turn to him with their guns pointed in the air. One of the prisoners lowers the barrel towards Giorgio, and Giorgio opens fire on them. Giorgio's superior, Del Buono, chews out Giorgio for his reckless decision. But at the time, Giorgio feels he was justified given the death of the little girl and her father. Despite the disagreement, both men see each other's point. Later, Del Buono is killed by a hitman, which shakes up the police department. Gianni Viviani takes over for Del Buono. Giorgio goes undercover to infiltrate the local organized crime in order to find out who killed Del Buono. He starts out with simple steps. He takes out an abusive pimp, he interrogates a fisherman with connections to the mafia, he steals a Rolls Royce, he interferes with a bank robbery. When Giorgio returns to the home of the pimp, he is confronted by Padulo, the local mob boss. Giorgio offers his driving skills to Padulo. After a tense test run, Padulo brings on Giorgio for a bank job. During the robbery, one of the robbers shoots a pregnant woman before rushing to the vehicle. This leads to a fast-paced car chase. We get some decent car crash carnage. Giorgio boldly drives into the middle of a police station to deliver the bank robbers to the cops. One of the robbers is taken down, but the others are taken into custody. The failed robbery puts Padulo in hot water with a mysterious anarchist organization. Padulo is told to leave the country since he was implicated in the bank robbery. Giorgio finds Padulo and wants him to name his higher-ups. Can Giorgio find out who killed Del Buono, or is he in a situation that's over his head? The Violent Professionals is a true representation of the gritty Italian subgenre of poliziotteschi. This edgy type of film was popular in the wake of Enzo Castellari's High Crime. Before High Crime, many of the cop action dramas were imported into Italy. Such films included Dirty Harry, The French Connection, Death Wish, and others. After High Crime, Italian filmmakers were emboldened to try their hand at this hot-of-the-moment subgenre. The public, tired of the constant police and government corruption, ate these movies up. However, the action and violence is too few and far between in this particular film. You have the violent opening of the prisoners escaping, you have a few robberies, and you have a few car chases. This would be too little to keep the 42nd Street audiences invested in the Violent Professionals. Much like I said with Confessions of a Police Captain, this film isn't rambunctious enough. The Violent Professionals does a few twists different from the tropes of the genre. With Franco Nero being the first actor in the first film of note in the genre, many films hired an actor like Maurizio Merli, who bared a strong resemblance to Nero. Merli was used so often that he was unfairly called the poor man's Franco Nero. Director Sergio Martino handles the police action and drama with sincerity, which helps with taking the film seriously. Martino was versatile when directing, dabbling in any and all genres. Horror, giallo, spaghetti western, cannibal, and post-apocalypse. Martino, with regards to genre, was a jack of all trades but a master of none. His films overall were fine but not as memorable as his contemporaries like Lucio Fulci or Dario Argento. For Violent Professionals, the lead is played by French actor Luc Miranda. Miranda gives off a much different vibe than that of Nero. Given Miranda's origins from France, Violent Professionals seems to be leaning towards the films of Alain Delon. Delon was often associated with French violent crime dramas like Les Samouraïs and No Way Out. Miranda still has the same cold-eyed stare as Delon. He makes for a nice change of pace. The bad guys in typical poliziotteschi are either a band of criminals or corrupt government officials. Here we have an underground group aiming to dismantle the democratic system of Italy through anarchistic means. The film goes into a more politically driven direction compared to a more straightforward approach to the genre. The two car chases in the film were under the expertise of Biagio Gambini. Gambini's other credits include Danger Diabolic and Street Law. Here we get some nice stunt work, notably a car crashing through flaming crates. Why were there flaming crates?
No fucking reason.
The music score was from Guido and Maurizio De Angelis. For a music score, it's all right. There isn't a hook, though. There's nothing in this score for me to gravitate to it. The score for Violent Professionals lacks the toe-tapping of their score for Street Law or the intensity of The Big Racket. I love their work as the De Angelis brothers and as Oliver Onions, but this film's score isn't memorable compared to what they would do later in their career. When I discuss the films of Enzo G. Castellari, you'll know what I mean. As I mentioned earlier, Miranda was a much welcomed alternative to Franco Nero and the actors used to exploit his popularity. Miranda makes for a captivating lead. Having Richard Conti in this film lends a lot of credibility, much like Martin Balsam in Confessions of a Police Captain. Conti was big in the noir genre with films like The Spider, Cry of the City, The Sleeping City, and The Big Combo. Thanks to a supporting role in the classic The Godfather, he enjoyed a career resurgence that followed for a few more films before he passed in 1975. The supporting roles in Violent Professionals feature some good talent. Silviano Tranquilli plays Gianni, a minor role that plays out later on. Martine Brochard plays a prostitute that begins to fall for Giorgio before realizing he's an undercover cop. Leah Tanzi plays the prostitute that serves as the point of entry into the criminal underworld for Giorgio. Stefan Zacharias plays a fisherman shaken down by Giorgio for information, one of the few funny scenes in an otherwise serious film. In the end, Violent Professionals is a decent starting point for people new to the poliziotteschi genre. There are better films, especially from the likes of Castellari, but with a good cast, a fine music score, not the best by the De Angelis brothers, but fine, some good action, you could do better or worse. The full movie can be found on YouTube.
Starring Lee Van Cleef as Mean Frank, fighting for his life and the empire he had built. Tony LoBianco as Crazy Tony, a kid who wanted nothing more than to be like Mean Frank. And Crazy Tony's sexy mistress, all she wanted was more Crazy Tony, played by sultry Edwige Finesse.
Mean Frank and Crazy Tony opens with a bunch of mobsters getting brutally murdered. A trio gets machine gunned down while another gets a power drill to the back of the head. These killings bring Frankie Diomedi back home to find out who is responsible for the deaths of his men and if someone in his organization is ratting out on him. The return of Frankie excites aspiring gangster Tony Beretta. Upon Frankie's arrival, he goes to one of his secret gambling establishments. There, he calls the police on himself. As the police show up, Tony gets the idea that saving Frankie from the cops will make him a made man. Both are arrested and thrown in jail for the night. Thanks to connections in the police department, Frankie is turned loose and visits an associate he knows to have ratted out on him. Frankie disposes of him by throwing him off a balcony. He returns to jail and is back in his cell, giving him a strong alibi. The next day, Frankie and Tony are transported to prison. While in the yard, an assassin tries to snipe Frankie, but Tony saves him. This incident cements Frankie's trust in Tony, but now Frankie is stuck in prison for his own quote-unquote protection. Meanwhile, Frankie's territory is being invaded by a French rival, Annunziata. He takes out both Frankie's lawyer and his brother, both with intimate details of Frankie's operations. Upon the news of the deaths, Frankie aims to take down Annunziata, and Tony is all the more happy to help him out. Between the trailer and the opening scenes, Mean Frank and Crazy Tony gives the impression of a serious revenge crime drama. Yet, there are hints of a buddy comedy here and there. Frankie and Tony are a nice dichotomy in the tradition of Lon Chaney Jr. and Shemp Howard. Yes, folks, Chaney Jr. and Shemp were a comedy team for a brief time. For the most part, the film takes itself seriously. The scenes with Frankie's plot of finding the rat in his organization and taking down Annunziata keep the film in a grim tone. These scenes are entertaining enough given the screen presence of Lee Van Cleef. The action in the film is well executed and even suspenseful at times. The shower fight is a bit distracting since the viewer can easily tell the film cuts back and forth between Van Cleef and a stunt double in a very bad hairpiece. The warehouse gunfight is a tense sequence. The car chase on the hilltop roads to Marseilles has its hair-raising moments with some good stunt driving and tight camera work. On a side note on the camera work, some of the film's cinematography was performed by Joe D'Amato. D'Amato would gain a reputation of infamy with gut-wrenching films like Anthropophagus and Beyond the Darkness. He would also do the Ator films, which were a knockoff of Conan the Barbarian, as well as a long list of hardcore pornography. There are some moments of violence that aren't gratuitous, but they will make you win. There are quite a few moments of comedy. One of the jokes has not aged well. There is a gay prisoner, which is very much a dated stereotype. But other than that, the humor is pretty much harmless. Some of the slapstick gags by Tony are a good laugh. Tony trying to enter Frankie's gambling house. A police car is literally broken in half during a car chase. And the French police officers still try to drive it. My favorite gag involves a burning junker car, dummies, and a tape recorder of people screaming. These serve as a distraction for the police that are escorting Frankie, and Tony uses these elements as a distraction to break out Frankie. Tony LoBianco has a natural knack for comedy. This gives the film an inconsistency in tone, but I still found the film enjoyable. Seeing Dino De Laurentiis as the producer shows Mean Frank and Crazy Tony as a film of promising potential. De Laurentiis's producing credits also include Death Wish with Charles Bronson, the 1976 remake of King Kong, Conan the Barbarian, Dune, Maximum Overdrive, Blue Velvet, Army of Darkness. This guy producing your movie was a big deal. Like many Italian directors, Michel Lupo dabbled in various genres. He started with sword and sandal films, then moved on to spaghetti westerns. He made a few Bud Spencer films. He never reached the height of some of his contemporaries, but his films are ripe for rediscovery. Writer Sergio Donati was a bit more successful. His earlier work with Sergio Leone on Once Upon a Time in the West and A Fistful of Dynamite made him one of Italy's go-to screenwriters. He would do solo efforts for both Bud Spencer and Terence Hill. His most high-profile credit would be Raw Deal, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger. Riz Ortolani shows up again in Making the Movies. Here, Ortolani does a basic music score compared to Confessions of a Police Captain. Using a lot of brass for the melody. He uses a recurring theme that can be implemented for dramatic purposes or building tension for a scene. The cast features no shortage of talent. Lee Van Cleef brings much credibility to the film. He has a seriousness that fits perfectly with the gritty tone of the film. He makes a surprisingly good foil for LoBianco. Speaking of Tony LoBianco, Mean Frank and Crazy Tony makes one of the only instances of him doing a comedy role. Most of LoBianco's work was in television and film dramas. Here he shows a good sense of comedic timing and works well off of the seriousness of Van Cleef. Edgewig Fennec, ugh, what a beauty. I was trying to figure out which image I wanted to use for the thumbnail. When I saw Miss Fennec, I knew I had to use her image. She doesn't do a whole lot in this film, but what she does, you won't soon forget. At almost 70 years old, she still looks stunning. There are a few noted actors in small supporting roles. We have Nello Pasafini as a prisoner that pushes Frankie's buttons. You know what it means when we have a Pasafini sighting.
I'm the best looking man in the Middle Ages. My, my, my.
Stefan Zacharias, whom we just talked about as the fisherman in Violent Professionals, plays a sleazy lawyer friend of Tony. He has a shaggy demeanor which plays nicely with LoBianco's humor-based performance. Romano Papo is a name you're going to hear a lot whenever we talk about Italian cinema. He was one of the best actor/stuntmen in the Italian film industry. He worked with almost everyone of note, from Sergio Leone to Lucio Fulci to Enzo G. Castellari. His stern, stone-faced look made him one of the Italian screen's more intimidating heavies. Mean Frank and Crazy Tony is one of those hidden gems that make exploring box sets exciting. It's a mix of comedy, action, revenge, with a solid casting crew, one of my favorites of the Grindhouse Experience Volume 1 so far. You can find the full movie on YouTube under the title Escape from Death Row. Not sure if that was a retitling to capitalize on the success of Escape from New York, which also featured Van Cleef. Fu Punch of Death centers on Chinese folk hero Feng Saiyuk. Feng's father was a wealthy merchant and his mother was a martial arts expert. The film opens with Feng and a rival engaging in a cricket fight. Soon, the competition leads to fisticuffs after Feng is accused of cheating by the rival. Feng ends up killing the rival but leaves the site before knowing so. In vengeance, the headmasters of the rival that was killed, Iron Fist and Iron Foot, vow to defeat his murderer. The headmasters go to Feng's home. They fight with the servants and his mother. Unfortunately, Feng's father is killed. Feng seeks his own vengeance and tries to go 2-on-1 against the headmasters. Feng is defeated despite a good showing. Under his mother's tutelage, he becomes a better fighter, but still not powerful enough to take out Iron Fist and Iron Foot. Stubborn, Feng goes after the headmasters again and is beaten again. As a last resort, the mother bathes Feng in a herbal bath. The herbs will make Feng invincible to the attacks of the headmasters. Now, you can ask why they didn't do this after the first fight. I think it was because his mother didn't want him to abuse this ability until it was certain that he couldn't beat the headmasters without it. Feng comes face to face with the headmasters and will challenge them to the death. Kung Fu Punch of Death, aka The Prodigal Boxer, is a Shaw Brothers production. The film is very much an exemplary piece of the chop sucky kung fu cinema of Hong Kong. These films were noted for their highly choreographed fight sequences, intense vocalizations, over-exaggerated facial expressions, and the dubbing performed by New Zealanders. Yeah, you heard right. New Zealand actors were often used in the dubbing, mostly because New Zealand actors were significantly cheaper than American actors. These types of martial arts movies were always popular with the 42nd Street audiences. Bruce Lee blew open the doors for these films to have an audience in the States, and the fans ate them up. You could go to the Anko Theater and watch a trio of martial arts movies. I'll let Joe Bob Briggs tell you about it.
My favorite movie that they show there is Always Three Kung Fu Hits. That's been running for years there, and you've seen it, have you?
Well, yeah, just in those loud, it's a huge noise.
That's right. And when you leave, you generally have to leave your shoes there in the theater. They just stick to the floor, and you say, oh, forget it.
But, It's always just three kung fu movies in a row.
Always three kung fu hits.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. They make all those noises.
Yeah. People in the Grindhouse theaters loved these movies. One question I have is regarding the credibility of the bad guys, Iron Fist and Iron Foot. These two are headmasters of a dojo. How can anyone take these two seriously if both of them are needed to take out a lesser combatant like Feng? These two are supposed to be among the best fighters, yet both of them, on a solo basis, can't take out Feng. Who would even bother to learn under these men if one can't fight without the other? plus the dojo's sidelines and stolen goods. Again, this goes to the credibility. If there is a risk of this operation getting out, how do they still have any students other than from people as villainous as them? We see them kill one of the merchants that deals with them. Given that, why would anyone want to do business with them and not go directly to the buyers? I know I'm thinking too deeply about this, but I can't help it. On a technical level, everyone contributes to a solid martial arts production. Pai Che Huang and Xia Yung Lu, as the fight choreographers, deliver tense, swift maneuvers. The music score by Cheng Chang does its job in accentuating the action, but does little to offer anything memorable. Ting Cheng's editing with Yung Sheng Chao's cinematography makes the action look good. Director Yang Ming Tsai brings it all together to make a satisfying kung fu film. Fei Meng plays the lead hero, Feng Sai-yuk. He plays the hero as headstrong and with ego, but grows into a more disciplined fighter as the film moves along. He develops at a speed believable to the audience. Despite my misgivings toward their characters' credibility, Yasuaki Kurata and Ching Wong have fun sneering for the camera as the villainous Iron Foot and Iron Fist, respectively. Lin Lin Lee gets the minor role as a possible love interest for Fong, but she has very little to do. The biggest crime this film commits is not giving proper credit to Hung Pai, who plays Fong's mother. She is one of the true badasses in this film. There's not really much to say about this film. If you enjoy the craziness of the chop sake genre from Hong Kong, then Kung Fu Punch of Death will be worth your time and can be seen in full on YouTube. But I have to say, Kung Fu Punch of Death is not as worthy of your time as the other Kung Fu film in the Grindhouse experience.
What do you want?
Nothing much. Looking for trouble.
Who are you?
I hear that you learn how to fight here. Thought I'd try out.
Punch!
In Return of the Tiger, Cheng Hung, along with a badass female assistant, is aiming to take down Paul the Westerner. Paul the Westerner is running a heroin racket in the home country of Cheng. At the same time, Hung is also playing the heroin racket of a local crime boss competing with Paul. Hung is hoping to kill two birds with one stone. Here you have the action of the chop sake martial arts with a little bit of Kurosawa's Yojimbo thrown in the mix. Short plot summary, I know, but this is by far the better of the two kung fu films in this volume of the Grindhouse experience. This film fits in the niche genre of Bruceploitation. In the wake of Bruce Lee's death in 1973, every martial artist under the sun tried to claim his throne. According to a supplemental interview with Paul L. Smith for the DVD release of the Italian horror film Pieces, the star of Return of the Tiger, Bruce Lai, was personally picked by the dragon Bruce Lee himself to continue the films meant for him. The film opens with a fight sequence that pits the female assistant against an entire gym of lackeys. There must have been at least 15 guys she was fighting. Much like with the two headmasters in Kung Fu Punch of Death, why hire all these lackeys when this one woman will be more than sufficient? But the fights in this film are pretty good, which I have to give credit to Sing Se. One fight pits Cheng against one of Paul's larger henchmen. Cheng rubs himself with baby oil to prep for the fight. Whenever the henchman grabs Cheng, Cheng just slips right out of his grasp. It's a comedic element, but the fight is still semi-serious. This is a nice blend of theatrics of Jackie Chan with the technical aspects of Bruce Lee. The closing fight between Cheng and Paul might be one of my favorite movie fights. This isn't like the typical kung fu film fight. This isn't two fighters using the same fighting style. This is East versus West. You have the Eastern fighting skills of Cheng going up against the roughneck Western style of Paul. I am much more interested in a fight with contrasting styles than with two people using the same style. One move that I had to call into question is a fight where a combatant headbutts another fighter. But this headbutt wasn't with the front of the head, but with the side of the head. From what I know about the human skull, the side of the skull is the thinnest part, or thinner compared to the front. At least the film recognizes this, with the one doing the headbutting passing out after delivering the blow. The music by Fu Lang Chao was alright. It's a synth-heavy sound, but what surprised me was the copious amounts of Wild Cherry. Who knew that an American one-hit wonder was so popular in Hong Kong, enough that three of their songs would be used? People may not recognize the name Wild Cherry, but everyone should at least know this song. Of the songs covered by Wild Cherry were also used. There was Nowhere to Run, originally performed by Martha and the Vandellas, and 99 and a Half Won't Do, which was an R&B staple previously performed by the likes of Wilson Pickett and Creedence Clearwater Revival. But there is a moment that reminded me of Godfrey Ho. For those who don't know, Godfrey Ho was essentially the Bruno Matai or Ed Wood of Hong Kong cinema. He was known for being cheap with his movies. Actor Richard Harrison hated him because Harrison would shoot a movie with Ho, and then Ho would turn around and spread out the one movie worth of shot footage for three or four movies, all while Harrison would only get paid for the one instead of for the three. Ho also had a knack for using music without obtaining the copyright. In the logo intro for one of his films, he directly lifts some of John Williams' score from Star Wars. Ho must have gotten this tactic from the director of Return of the Tiger, Jimmy Shaw. Shaw blatantly takes a famous cue from the James Bond films. Here's the original cue from Bond. And now here is the cue used in Return of the Tiger. The cast features a number of talents native to the chop sake genre. Bruce Lai as Chang has charisma and he has a good look. The passing resemblance to Bruce Lee doesn't hurt either. I have only seen Lai in one other film, Bruce Lee vs. Superman, which mixed both the Bruceploitation film with a Hong Kong knockoff of the Three Fantastic Supermen. So there you have a Hong Kong knockoff of an Italian knockoff of an American superhero. Speaking of Bruce Lee versus Superman, the actor who played Superman in that film, Fei Lung, also appears in this film as a fighting instructor. Angela Mao kicks all sorts of ass as Chang's sidekick. She has plenty of kung fu films under her belt. Since Lai was given the mantle as the successor of Bruce Lee, it helps to have Mao working with him on screen to give him more credibility. She played Lee's sister in the classic Enter the Dragon, and she also appeared in Godfrey Ho's Ninja the Violent Sorcerer. See, it all comes back around. Now we have to talk about Paul L. Smith. This man had one interesting career. He got his start in Exodus for director Otto Preminger. Exodus allowed him to rub elbows with the likes of Paul Newman, Lee J. Cobb, and Sal Mineo. Because he had a striking resemblance to Italian actor Bud Spencer, he actually worked on a few films in Italy with Antonio Cantafora, billed as Michael Kobe. Here, the filmmakers were actually playing off of the popularity of the Spencer and Hill films by having a duo that shared a striking resemblance. Smith and Cantafora worked together for about five or six films. I'm sure this played a part in him getting the role in Return of the Tiger. I'll explain that in a bit. Smith's other credits include plenty of TV appearances. He was Bluto in Popeye with Robin Williams. He was the groundskeeper Willard in the cult horror film Pieces. He was a highlight in the Sam Raimi Coen Brothers collaboration Crime Wave. He was also in Dune for David Lynch. I have a feeling Paul Smith was cast in Return of the Dragon because Jimmy Shaw and the producers wanted Bud Spencer, but it could have been a case of language barrier, or Spencer may have been too expensive or out of shape for the action sequences. Smith was brought in because he was more agile. He has a black belt in Taekwondo, which gives him credibility in the martial arts genre. The sequences we see with Paul the Westerner near the end just scream Bud Spencer. He does the same moves Spencer does. Granted, I haven't seen a Bud Spencer film. I have seen a number of YouTube videos of fight montages with Spencer, as well as the Slaps and Beans video game. Paul does the fist pound to the head, the banging heads of two henchmen together. One guy sits on his shoulders, and Paul uses the guy's feet to knock out other guys. He even runs through a brick wall. The only thing missing is putting the music of Oliver Onions over the fight. Bells and whistles, for example. I absolutely enjoyed this film. It was as close as we'd get to Bruce Lee versus Bud Spencer, and I'll take it. It's a toss-up between Return of the Dragon or Mean Frank and Crazy Tony as my favorite of this batch. And that finishes this round of movies. We are now 12 movies in, and I need to update the rank with the new films included. I'll give you the films from worst to best. At the bottom, it's still Tortured Angels. Just above it is Women's Camp 119. Earthquake 7.9 would be next. Then Savage Band, Savage Beast. 8 would be Kung Fu Punch of Death. 7 would be The Violent Professionals. 6 would be The Executioner Part 2. 5 would be The Poseidon Explosion. 4 would be Raw Force. 3 would be Confessions of a Police Captain. 2 would be Return of the Tiger. 1 would be Mean Frank and Crazy Tony. That's right. 2 of the recently reviewed films have jumped to the front of the line. They are that good. Here's a bit of a postamble. I'm one of those people who still buy physical media for movies. Video games are another postamble for another time. I'm reluctant to convert from DVDs and Blu-rays in favor of streaming and owning digital copies of films. I currently only have a few TV seasons on iTunes, Better Call Saul and Ash vs. Evil Dead. On Amazon, I only have 3 movies in my digital library, The Lego Movie, Murder by Death, and Brain Donors. If push comes to shove, I'll buy physical copies for The Lego Movie and Murder by Death, since they won't cost me an arm and the leg. Brain Donors, on the other hand, is impossible to find on DVD, because Paramount must still be bitter with the Zucker Brothers. I'll go into greater detail when I discuss Brain Donors for the Underrated Comedies episode after Halloween. Everything else I own is physical copies. For starters, physical copies are easier to share with others, and there's something to show for. I look at my collection of DVDs, and I can see myself reflected in the selections. Plus, whenever I go to a con, I have something for the celebrities there to sign. With Scarecon coming up, I notice a number of people from the Friday the 13th series will be there. Perfect for me since I had the 8-movie box set that came out a couple of years ago. In 2015, I had the pleasure of meeting Barry Bostwick, probably best known for his work on the Rocky Horror Picture Show. I brought a copy of FDR American Badass for him to sign. When he saw my physical copy, he was clearly touched. He looked at me and said, "You own this. You actually bought it." My response was, "Yeah, how else are you supposed to support these movies other than buying them?" Boswick lamented that a lot of people just torrent or pirate movies. It's a shame. That's why we don't have Ash vs. Evil Dead anymore. On Twitter this past week, a gentleman by the name of Brian Tellerico showed one of the biggest downsides of streaming. He was watching Die Hard, one of the greatest Christmas movies ever made, and he noticed the aspect ratio of the picture was off when he was watching on HBO Now. HBO Now cuts off significant portions of the picture. You're not seeing the whole movie, you're not getting all of what you paid for. But here's an instance that really peeved me off. A Twitter user, Anders G. Da Silva, complained to iTunes about 3 of the movies he purchased being removed from his library. The content provider of those movies couldn't come to an agreement with Apple, and those movies had to be removed from the Apple Store and from the libraries of the people who purchased them. I find it hard to believe that with all the billions of dollars Apple pulls in every year, that they couldn't afford to renew the licensing from the content creator. What ticked me off more was the quote-unquote compensation to the user who lost these movies. To purchase a movie on iTunes, from what I've seen, can cost between $10 to $20. For 3 movies, that's between $30 to $60. That's quite a bit of pocket change. How did Apple attempt to right this wrong? I'll read you Apple's response verbatim. "We appreciate you taking the time to submit this request and for being a valued iTunes Store customer. I am so glad to see our advisor had issued you 2 movie rental credits to rent a movie available on the iTunes store, priced up to $5.99 USD. So $11 when the customer lost out on $30 to $60.
Are you out of your fucking mind?
If that was me, I would never give Apple another penny of my money. I would delete my iTunes. I would trade in my iPhone. Apple has no respect for the consumer. And this nonsense only further shows me why physical media is still the better investment. At least no one can take my DVDs away like they can take away movies from digital libraries. Physical media is your friend. And that's it for this episode of Mac and the Movies. Thanks for listening. Next time we have a pair of westerns, Go Kill and Come Back, a.k.a. Any Gun Can Play from Enzo G. Castellari, with Bounty Man from John Llewellyn Moxie. Moxie was the director of the TV movie The Night Stalker with Darren McGavin. We also have a pair of Blaxploitation, 3 Tough Guys with Isaac Hayes, probably better known as Chef from South Park, and Fred the Hammer Williamson. Okay, I am really excited for this one. And the other film is called Mandinga. A plantation owner lusts after his female slaves. And the joyfulness is over. If you enjoy this content, feel free to follow me on social media and follow this podcast on the platform of your choice. There's Podomatic, Google Music, Spotify, and of course, after talking crap about them, iTunes. I have a Facebook and Twitter page as well. If you would like to see this program go, consider supporting my Patreon. $1 a month will net you a special thanks credit. $3 a month will allow you to contribute to the creative direction of Mac and the Movies. If you prefer a one-time donation, I have a PayPal as well. A $5 donation will net you a credit as a movie review sponsor. Links for everything in the description. I'm Mackenzie Lambert with Mac and the Movies. Until next time, take care, everyone.